for me as a soldier to encourage people to join the military where that might happen to them. Now, I don't think those rules of engagement are still in effect, but I don't know that.
Well, so a lot of them have changed. I mean, and you can tell by the results on the battlefield. I mean, ISIS, their territorial integrity was taken apart so quick because you now have a commander-in-chief that's not micromanaging generals in the field or White House staffers calling down to, you know, the operational and tactical level commanders and bypassing the Pentagon and Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I think that that is why we're successful in getting things done. Can they still be improved? Absolutely. But I think right now what the focus has to be is on these young men that have been wronged over these past few years, and a couple of them have had exculpatory evidence withheld in their cases. And that means that you have military lawyers that are doing things that are unprofessional, unethical, too, that should cause them to be disbarred.
Well, I don't know this to be true, but I believe it's true that when the Army downsized 10 years ago or 15 years ago, somebody decided to keep the JAG Corps, the lawyers, the same number. So now all of a sudden, every battalion has got a lawyer in it. When I was in combat, I served at division level for a while. I never saw one lawyer. And now apparently battalions, and they're interrogating people when they come back from combat. I don't get that at all. That's certainly nothing like any combat unit I could imagine. It's got to be horrible.
Yeah, and it is horrible. And the thing is that it makes guys second guess themselves in a firefight or in an engagement or a potential engagement. And you and I very well know that in a firefight, in the first 2 to 3 seconds, someone could lose their life. And you don't want to see our troops in combat and in contact, you know, cede over the initiative to the enemy because they're fearful of some lawyer that is sitting back there, you know, fat, dumb, and happy on the forward operating base or at a larger base, you know, having nice hot coffee and hot chow while they're out there doing the work and being the guardians of this republic and being the watchman on the wall.
Yeah, and, you know, I can't even imagine a battalion, a squad, a platoon coming back and having some lawyer say to you, the private standing next to me, did Gillum shoot somebody? Yes. Did he have a good reason to? Because if you'll testify against him, we won't charge you.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what's happening.
And that just, well, I'm already a little nuts, but that makes me even crazier. How do you lead troops like that? How, as a leader, do you not stand up and say, then I resign, get me out of here, I can't live in this environment? How do we have generals who live with that?
Well, it's tough because what ends up happening is these folks break down unit cohesion.
Yeah.
Because they start to, you know, pit, you know, the troops against their combat leaders, you know, being them senior enlisted or officers. And you also have this sense of the commissar, you know, how they used to have in the old Soviet Union army, the person that is there not to support the unit, but to report things up to a different and separate chain of command. And then that also causes a very tentative, very anxiety-oriented atmosphere in a unit because they don't feel that they're free to go out and do their job. They don't feel that they're free, you know, when they have come back from a patrol or whatever, to sit down and shoot the you-know-what, as we used to say.
Yeah.
Because someone might be taking notes and someone might come back and do something against them.
And therefore you can't relax. There's more to discuss about this, and Colonel West is going to stay with us. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom Troops. It's push-up time. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do every day. Then take a break to stay in the area. Colonel West and I will be right back. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. I ordered my men to open fire on the enemy in Vietnam. For doing the same thing in Afghanistan, Lieutenant Clint Lawrence was court-martialed and sent to Fort Leavenworth under President Obama. Now Green Beret Major Matthew Goldstein and Navy SEAL Chief Edward Gallagher have been court-martialed. Killing terrorist combatants ought not to be a crime. To restore freedom to those who fought for ours, sign my petition at restorefreedom.info. Congressman Duncan Hunter and I will deliver your message to Washington. Let's rally for unfairly accused combat warriors. Restorefreedom.info. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This message is paid for by the Uniformed Services League.
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Morning Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Front Lines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation about abused combat veterans with Colonel Alan West. So we very much agree that one of the problems is there's too many lawyers. I mean, I guess if I was a young lawyer and I joined the Army and they assigned me to a unit, a battalion or something, I'd want to do something. So I guess that's understandable that they go out and try to do the lawyer thing. But I think the Army, I presume Marines, Navy, I don't know about them, needs to reduce the number of lawyers, one, to save the money, but two, to help us restore combat readiness and combat cohesion. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I think that one of the most important things is that I like the Marine Corps model. Every Marine is a rifleman, first and foremost. And so even if you're going to be a JAG officer in the Marine Corps, you're going to go to the basic school, TBS, and you're going to learn what it's like to be, you know, a ground combat Marine. That's their foundation. So I think that when you have people that, you know, finish law school, you slap a uniform on them, and then they go to a unit, and all of a sudden they're the JAG officer there, whichever side of the JAG bench they're on, they don't have the same understanding of what it means to be out there at the tactical level and really be around those troops on the ground. And then all of a sudden, as we talked about in the previous segment, you know, when they're there, you know, they create a sense of anxiety and they create a sense of distrust because you have your soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines that are there and they don't really understand why this person is here, what they're to do. Is he taking notes? Is he keeping a list? I mean, what have you? Well, you know, think about the movie Lone Survivor, how here you have a compromised, you know, Navy SEAL reconnaissance mission and their biggest concern in dealing with those Afghan sheep herders was that they didn't want bodies to be found, and next thing you know, they were going to be on CNN or whatever as war criminals. So what did they do? They let them go, and it ended up three of the four in that team lost their lives, and then we also had that helicopter that was shot down as part of that rescue mission. And so that's what we don't want to have. We don't want to have our young men and women on the ground second-guessing themselves. And a great case, you know, Clint Lawrence, a Texan, yep, young man who ordered the firing on of the Taliban. I mean, the Taliban uses motorcycles. They scout out your position, and then they report back what they have seen. They were ordered not to come near the position, you know, and they continued to close on the position. Clint ordered the firing of them. Now, what Clint is sitting around with 15 to 20 years in prison in Fort Leavenworth for premeditated murder. This is what we ask our combat leaders to do, is to kill and engage the enemy. But yet when you have someone that is a deserter, like Bo Bergdahl, some Army judge decides that he suffered enough and he should go free, even though he admitted to being a deserter. And he basically admitted and pled guilty to the fact that three or four other soldiers had lost their lives trying to find him. So, you know, what message does that send to these young troops in the on the ground when the deserter gets to go free.
I agree.
Me being here and doing what I'm supposed to do, now I'm the one sitting in prison.
Well, I did what Clint Lawrence did when I was in Vietnam. My first tour, I was a first lieutenant, new platoon leader in combat. At least one occasion, my troops told me that what they saw, and I ordered, I didn't have a gun truck, mortars or artillery, I don't remember what, I ordered to be engaged. That's what I was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if ever there was a classic example of a platoon leader doing exactly what his job is supposed to be, Clint Lawrence is an example of that.
You're right. And what ends up happening is that, you know, you fast forward about, I think, 3 or 4 years, and there's an Air Force patrol in Afghanistan, and a motorcycle with a couple of folks, suicide bomber, approaches their patrol. They didn't take any action. And guess what happens? They detonate, and the members of that patrol are killed because in the back of their minds, they have these, like you say, the goofy rules of engagement, and they don't want to end up in jail. They don't want to end up in prison. I mean, don't, if you think that our troops are not talking about these cases and talking about these situations, you know, hey, you got to be careful. You probably shouldn't want to do this. You don't want to do that. You don't want to end up like Lieutenant Lawrence or whomever that's sitting back, you know, in Fort Leavenworth. I don't want to lose my freedom. I'll take the chance of this happening. And what that means is that they're putting their lives in danger because they're more so afraid of lawyers on the battlefield than the enemy on the battlefield. And that's a horrible thing.
That is horrible. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Colonel Alan West. Alan, there was recently an event in Washington, D.C. to bring public attention to this issue, and I think you were a speaker there. And there's going to be another one on the 10th of July in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
There are groups out there, but the goal of the groups is to influence the president and or Congress to get these people, one, out of jail, but two, have the conviction removed from their lives. And that's mm-hmm. something our listeners can do. They can contact their congressman. They can write the president. The event on the 10th of July is called the Restore Freedom event. RestoreFreedom.info will give you all the information you want on it. And again, the purpose is to bring the attention of the president on these. There are some soldiers that did stupid criminal things. We're not talking about them. We're talking about the soldiers who did their job the way they should have done it and had their convicted murderers today if they're out of prison yet. Those are the people we want to stand up for. Alan, thank you for talking about that. Take a minute now and talk about what you're doing in Texas besides being a guest on Frontlines of Freedom.
Well, you know, we continue to stand up and fight for, you know, freedom and liberty here in Texas. The progressive socialist left has the Lone Star State in their sights. That's why, you know, I wrote the book, Hold Texas, Hold the Nation, Victory or Death. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can follow me on TheOldSchoolPatriot.com. That's our website. And then also on Facebook, on YouTube, and Instagram. So we're just trying to make sure that we honor the oath that you and I took to the Constitution of the United States of America and keep this a free country.
Alan, thank you. Thank you for taking time to join us today, and thank you for your service to our nation. I'm proud to call you brother.
Airborne, sir, all the way.
That event on the 10th of July, go to restorefreedom.info. That's restorefreedom.info. Now it's time for our Stand Tall Troop Report. This is when I find an outstanding performance of duty, and we get to honor this fine troop. A former staff sergeant, Army guy, who took on enemy fighters at close range, first with an M249 light machine gun and then with a knife, will be the first living veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom to receive a Medal of Honor. He's also a talk radio host, so this guy's a great guy. David Bellavia, 43, of Batavia, New York, will receive the medal on June 25th at the White House. His Silver Star citation for heroism on 10 November 2004 in Fahula, Iraq, read like the script for an action movie. An infantryman with Company A, 1st Infantry Division, 2nd Task Force 22, Bellavia was ordered with his platoon to clear a 12-building block in which jihadists were taking shelter in order to fire on American troops. They cleared the first nine with no problems. Bellavia and four other soldiers entered the 10th building and found them under fire from insurgents. As more soldiers rushed to reinforce, the close-quarters combat became hot and intense, and troops began to go down with injuries. At this point, Sergeant Bellavia, armed with a saw machine gun, entered the room where the insurgents were located and sprayed the room with gunfire, forcing the jihadists to take cover and allowing the squad to move out into the street. He'd find himself one man pitted against a house full of armed fighters. He first encountered an insurgent with a rocket-propelled grenade and took him out. He would continue to fight and fell insurgents until he was joined by five other members of his platoon. He left the Army in 2005 after 6 years of service, co-founded a political advocacy organization, Veterans for Freedom. He documented his military experiences in House to House, an epic memoir of war, co-written with John Bruning and published in 2007. So stand tall, Sergeant Beliva. Front Lines of Freedom of all of our nation's patriots salute you. This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Renee Nickel about her book about her warrior brother. Then Nathaniel Philbrick will discuss his book, In the Hurricane. And then we'll talk with weatherman Bill Steffen about his warrior dad. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our Armed America report. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, it's time to run. Run a couple of miles of wind sprints. Then grab some protein and rehydrate with water. Finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.
Now is the time, and wherever you are is the place. The Citadel makes it easier to earn your degree by offering master's degrees, graduate certificates, and undergraduate degree completion programs entirely online. Flexible scheduling makes these programs convenient for working professionals. Continuing the Citadel's legacy of academic excellence, classes are held to the same high standards that consistently name the Citadel the number one master's-granting public college in the South. Online, on your time. Visit citadel.edu/online.
Wouldn't it be great to see your windows in a whole new light? Do it right. Call your local neighborhood experts. Budget Blinds. You'll get beautiful style and personalized service for every budget. We bring the showroom right to your home, so you can choose from hundreds of blinds, shades, shutters, and drapes, plus smart home window coverings you control with the touch of a button. And with Budget Blinds, we do it all for you. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy. There's a reason why Budget Blinds is the number one provider of custom window coverings in North America. When we say we have style and service for every budget, we really mean it. So let's get your home a whole lot of gorgeous. Get your free consultation right at home. Just go online to budgetblinds.com or call 855-BUDGET-BLINDS. Call 855-BUDGET-BLINDS for your free consultation right at home. Now that's beautiful. At participating independently owned and operated franchises only. Ask for details.
I started going cold turkey, at least when I'm in the car.
I know I shouldn't do it, but it's so hard to stop. That's why I hide it.
I do it all the time. I stopped by locking it in my glove compartment.
My friend used to do it way too much. Now I turn it off when we're in the car.
My solution is simple. I just don't do it.
There are lots of ways to stop yourself and others from texting and driving. How will you stop? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Speaking in New Jersey, President Trump was pressed about delaying new tariffs on China.
Are we doing this for Christmas season? Just in case some of the tariffs would have an impact on U.S. customers, which so far they've had virtually none.
Tariffs on Chinese products, including electronics, video game consoles, cell phones, along with some clothing and shoes, were set to go into effect on September 1st. The new target for setting those imposing tariffs is December 15th. For the second straight day, protesters are in a Hong Kong airport. Gordon Chang is an expert on relations between China and Hong Kong He tells Fox News,
"This is a leaderless revolution, and that gives it weaknesses and strengths. And it's very difficult for China to control it because there's nobody there to talk to."
The protests have been going on in Hong Kong since June, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
It is a horrible scenario, but it happens. Dennis writes about his wife. She was diagnosed with leukemia. In fact, she's a two-time survivor, and in the midst of all that, they ran up over $1 million in medical bills. Thankfully, they're Medishare members, and Dennis says they are so thankful for that, how others came together to meet their needs, and that's how so many Medishare members feel. This is not health insurance. It's different. You don't have to pay for things you don't believe in, and like Dennis found out, it just works. So if you join Medishare, not only do you save a lot of money, the typical family saves about $500 a month, but you know where your money's going each month. You're helping people, and if the time should come, they'll be helping and even praying for you. So yes, it's different, and as more than 400,000 people now know, when it comes to healthcare costs, different is beautiful. Find out more. Call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
President Trump is in western Pennsylvania touting the growth of U.S. energy production and the U.S. economy. Rick Perry is the energy secretary. He tells Fox News,
"Reality is that the United States is lowering emissions, one of the only countries in the world. Matter of fact, I think about all the 194 that signed on to the Paris Accord, the U.S. is the one that's leading the world in reducing emissions."
The first lawsuit related to Legionnaires' disease at a popular hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, is filed. With more on the story, here's USA Radio Network's Robin Walensky.
A lawsuit filed in Atlanta against the owners of the Sheraton Hotel after a man gets sick coming down with Legionnaires' disease. One woman who stayed there died, and at least 12 other confirmed cases. The hotel closed and is being cleaned.
In July, business owners' expectations for business conditions, real sales, and expansion were all up. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
The family of a 91-year-old woman in Illinois is suing a nursing home where she resided after a video posted on social media in December shows two staffers taunting her with a hospital gown. Margaret Collins was a patient at a nursing home just outside of Chicago when a video was posted on Snapchat showing two nursing assistants teasing the woman with a gown. Collins' daughter, Joan Beeble, joins Fox News and shares her reaction when she saw the video.
When I saw it, it was total disbelief. You know, you're just trying to wrap your arms around what happened. And, you know, you're disgusted by it. And then you're almost in a panic. What do you do next to protect her?
Mm-hmm.
We're at a place, at a nursing home, yeah, where she thought that she was absolutely safe.
Beeble also shares how this is affecting her now.
Well, you know, you're always damaged by it, you know, and, you know, we did move our mom as soon as we could find a place that met her needs. And but still to this day, you know, you just feel like she has been forever impacted by this. It was a terrible thing to have to move her at that age.
And as far as how her mother is doing?
Well, you know, she's doing fine. But I do say that, you know, she will be forever impacted by what has happened to her.
For more news, follow us on Facebook at USA Radio. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Oh, folks, you know what that music is. That's the time for modern design. This blue thing is a really new trend. A lot of the designers are trying to introduce blue as a new cabinet color.
This is topical for you guys. This is really topical.
And the mother said, well, I'd like her room to be gray. And the little girl said, Mom, gray is the color of depression.
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good Morning Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Hoo-ah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciates you joining us this fine day in America. I have several friends who are the alumni of the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. This great institution allows cadets to further their education and earn a commission in our military if they desire, which about one in every three does. Ranked as the number one public college in the South, the Citadel also offers master's degree graduate certificates online or on campus. If you're looking for a bachelor or master's degree, this might be the college for you. Check citadel.edu. Here's what we have for you this hour. First, Renee Nickel will share about her book, Always My Hero, about her Marine brother. Then we'll discuss how the Revolutionary War really was won with author Nathaniel Philbrick. And Bill Steffens will share stories about his combat veteran's father on this Our Father's Day show. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our Armed America report. Troops, I welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's a pleasure to introduce Renee Nickel. She's a Gold Star sister who lost her Marine brother in combat, and she's written an amazing book about him entitled Always My Hero. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom, Renee.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Renee, tell us a little bit about your background. Talk about growing up with your brother Sam.
We just had a blast. We grew up in the mountains of Pennsylvania, and, you know, we were latchkey kids. Both our parents worked, and so, you know, we had a lot of freedom to just roam around and find adventures and get into trouble, try to get out of trouble. So, you know, he was just a character, just really, really warm and funny, and we just had a great time growing up in Pennsylvania. And then when I was 10 years old, when we moved to North Carolina area, and then from there, after which I became a military wife, and he joined the Marines, and so we've been all over since then.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, I grew up with three sisters, and I always thought it was a brother's job to pick on sisters. Did your brother do a good job of picking on you?
Oh, he sure did. Yeah, you know, he always told me that he was going to give me a knuckle sandwich, and I know, I didn't know what that was, but I know I never wanted a knuckle sandwich. And, you know, he would hold me down and he'd give me Indian burns for, you know, harassing him. And
okay.
So,
A good brother. What else can we say? Okay.
Exactly.
So when and why did he join the Marines?
Well, he always wanted to be a pilot from the time he was about 5 years old. And we thought he would become an astronaut, or, you know, his original plan was to join the Air Force. And when it came time for him to go to college, he wanted to go to Penn State, which he did. And he joined the Navy ROTC at Penn State. But after his first semester, the Marine Corps offered him a full ride. if he switched to the Marines. So he could still fly jets. That was his goal. And so that's how he ended up joining the Marine Corps.
What were your feelings about him joining the military in general and the Marines in particular?
I didn't think really one way or another. You know, my dad was in the Army. You know, a lot of my uncles were in the military, Air Force, Army. My grandparents all served in World War II. I wasn't worried or anything. It just seemed like the natural course for him. And my mom had some concerns about him being a Marine. And, you know, and when I was 16 years old, when he went to college, I didn't really know the difference between Air Force, Marines, Army. You know, it wasn't really until I was became a military spouse that I really learned the differences of the branches.
That makes sense. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're discussing the book, Always My Hero, with Renee Nickel. Okay, so he became a Marine, obviously a pilot. How did your relationship with him change, or did it change, when he was now a pilot in the military and you're not?
Well, you know, I was always really proud of him. And I would brag to people, to my friends, any chance I got. My brother flies F-18s because I thought it was the coolest thing in the world that my brother flew jets. And to me, he was just my big brother, you know, sometimes annoying, sometimes, you know, just silly. Yeah. And so I never really saw him as this Marine Corps officer who flies jets. You know, a lot of people respected, because to me, he's still the guy who would punch me in the arm when I was 21 years old.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so I thought it was really cool that he flew jets, but, you know, to me, he was just still Sam. But it was hard, you know, kind of living in his shadow. You know, I kind of just lived in his shadow most of our childhood and growing up.
Okay. Talk about his time in combat.
His first tour in Iraq, he just it was in 2003. It was after 9/11, and he went for, you know, straight 90 days and dropped some ordnance in Iraq. And then, you know, his second tour was to Iraq. It was after he stopped flying, and he became a forward air controller with the 4th Anglico. And, you know, he didn't see too much action. And I think his I think there's, you know, a few reasons why he went to Afghanistan for the third tour while he volunteered. But, you know, I think he wanted to see some combat. You know, he had been training for years with the 4th Anglico. And so that, you know, I mean, he ended up losing his life 5 weeks into the tour. You know, so he you know, just unfortunately just was seeing too much combat. You know, he...
Okay.
He stepped in for another one of his other Marines, so.
Okay. And talk about that now as his sister. When you found out what happened, how did you and your family respond?
When I found out, it was the morning of December 14th in 2011, and I was getting my kids ready for school. I was, we were actually stationed at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. And, you know, I was planning on going shopping, and it was 7:30 in the morning, and my phone rings, and it's my mom. And I'm wondering why my mom is calling me at 7:30 in the morning. And, you know, and I was just like, oh, it's my mom, you know? So I picked up the phone. I was like, hey, Mom, you know, and she's crying hysterically. I can't even understand a word she's saying. And, you know, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, something must have happened to my brother. Like, he must have been injured, but, you know, I had this moment where I'm relieved that he, at least he's coming home, because in my mind, my brother was invincible, like just untouchable. You know, to me, he was and is my hero. And I just never saw him as someone who could lose his life in war. And, you know, my mom just kind of slowed her talking, and she was like, you know, Renee, Sam was killed in Afghanistan, and I just lost it. You know, I dropped the phone, fell to my knees, and you know, it was a tough day.
Of that, I believe. Folks, we're going to give away a copy of this book, Always My Hero, at the end of the show. But, Renee, I'm sure some listeners will want to buy them. I presume it's available on Amazon and lots of other places.
It is. Any online retailer has it available.
He obviously had a family, so this is our Father's Day show. I take it that he was also a darn good father.
He was an excellent father. You know, he lost his life the day before his youngest son's birthday, his sixth birthday. And, you know, and I have a daughter now who's 4 years old. I have a son who's eight. And, you know, and actually my second daughter was five at the time when Sam was killed. And you know, and every time they reach an age, you know, and I think about, you know, those boys and how they lost their dad. He had two sons. One was, you know, like I said, had just turned six, and the other one was turning eight a few months later. But he was an outstanding dad. He wanted to spend every single moment he could with them when he was home.
Sounds like Always My Hero is an appropriate title. Renee, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for honoring one of our nation's true heroes. He was a husband and a father, and we honor him especially on this Father's Day. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up, we'll discuss the Revolutionary War with historian Nathaniel Philbrick. Then my friend Bill Steffen will discuss his combat vet dad. You've reported for duty to Front Lines of Freedom. I want you to balance on 1 foot for 3 minutes, then balance on the other foot for 3 minutes. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back.
This hour of Front Lines of Freedom is brought to you by HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net is an online resource and information center dedicated to the welfare of those who have sacrificed for the freedoms, ideals, and morals we Americans hold dear to our hearts. At HelpVet.net, find information on benefit-related issues from education, healthcare, military pay, retirement, VA loans, and resources on education, finance, legal, health and wellness, the military life, moving and housing, travel and entertainment, and much, much more. Visit HelpVet.net, HelpVet.net.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coriel with your home defense tip of the week. Look like sheep and you'll be eaten by wolves. According to interviews done with armed robbers, you are far more likely to be targeted by criminals if you look weak and helpless. Carry yourself with pride and military bearing, because many criminals can spot a soft target with one glance. Stay alert and aware of your surroundings. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit HomeDefenseShow.com.
American investors lost $3.7 trillion of net worth in the fourth quarter of 2018. When your portfolio's value decreases right before or early in your retirement, it can have a crippling effect. It's called sequence of returns risk, and it's a risk you simply cannot afford. We're Sound Income Strategies, and we're on a mission to help hardworking Americans transform their hard-earned savings into steady, predictable retirement income. Call now for free, no-obligation information to help you get started on your way to steady, predictable retirement income. Call 866-913-1234. 866-913-1234. Investment advisory services offered through Sound Income Strategies, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Let's transform that risk into income. Call 866-913-1234. 866-913-1234. Sound Income Strategies, powered by the Retirement Income Store.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Front Lines of Freedom. It's a pleasure to introduce the noted author and historian Nathaniel Philbrick. He's written about our Revolutionary War. His latest book, In the Hurricane's Eye, is clearly on that topic. And it showed an aspect of the war that I knew existed but didn't realize I didn't understand. I guess you're really a naval guy, Nathaniel, so should I say welcome aboard?
Yeah, that sounds appropriate for a guy who lives on Nantucket Island, yeah.
Okay, that works. Give us a little bit of your background into your history. How did you become interested in and involved in history in general, early history and naval history?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in that maritime center of the universe, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But when I was a kid, summering at my grandparents' place on Cape Cod, I learned how to sail. And for me, that was just transformative. I love the sense of independence. I just, you know, love being out on the water, the interaction with nature and all that. And I became a competitive small boat racer in college. And then when my wife and I turned 30, we had two little kids. My wife was a lawyer, and she had been working in Boston, but the commute to the house we owned outside Boston was driving both of us crazy. She got a job on Nantucket, and I was a huge fan of Moby Dick's at that point. I've always regarded that novel as my personal Bible. And we, of course, were moving to what had been in the 19th century the whaling capital of the world,
yeah.
Nantucket. And so I became interested in the history of what was now my adopted home and would write my first work of history, A Way Offshore, A History of Nantucket. And that introduced me to the story of the Essex disaster, the whale ship that was rammed by a whale in 1820 and eventually inspired the climax of Moby Dick, which I wrote about in the heart of the sea. And so that sort of set me on the path I've been on ever since. Each book seems to evolve organically from the one before it. And I've always had kind of a maritime interest coming from the perspective I do. I think, you know, America's been defined by a sense of wilderness, and we think of that as the West. But before there was the West, there was the sea that was really the defining wilderness of this country. And I think it's an underappreciated and an important part of our history.
I've never thought about putting it the way you just did, but I couldn't agree more with you. And also, when I learned to sail, I got totally hooked on it, but I wasn't able to continue it. So you actually lived out what I sort of started wanting to do. So that's cool. Okay, let's talk about In the Eye of the Hurricane. That really, as I mentioned before, touches what were, at least to me, and I'm a bit of a historian in that area, some not realized parts of how we were winning the Revolutionary War is the right word. But how we made the movement that led to a successful end to the war.
Well, you know, even for me, a maritime guy, I didn't fully appreciate the importance of the sea to the ultimate course of the American Revolution. You know, I grew up thinking of it as kind of linear, each battle a stepping stone to the next battle that ultimately led to our victory at Yorktown. But in writing the three books about the Revolution, Bunker Hill and Valiant Ambition Proceeding in the Hurricane's Eye, I began to appreciate that it wasn't that way at all. By 1780, when Benedict Arnold unsuccessfully attempts to surrender West Point to the British, the war has devolved into a stalemate. The British, under Sir Henry Clinton, are dug into New York, you know, more than 10,000 soldiers there. Washington is based on the Hudson, basically just staring at Clinton. Washington complains that the war drags on like a cart without wheels. You know, there's fighting happening, but most of that's to the south, and it's not good. Horatio Gates, the hero of Saratoga, loses the Battle of Camden to Lord Cornwallis. And, you know, it's just kind of, we're stuck in a rut. And what Washington realized was that the only way he could win the victory that might end this thing in a favorable way for America was with the help of the French Navy. The French had joined the war in the spring of 1778. And up until that point, Britain, which was the most powerful naval force in the world, had control of the Atlantic seaboard, which meant that they could not only take any harbor or city on the water that they chose to, but they could transport their troops up and down the seaboard with relatively lightning speed. And there's just nothing Washington could do to contain them. But if the French Navy should bring over a naval force that was roughly equivalent and establish naval superiority along a section of the American coastline, that would give Washington the opportunity to win the victory on land that might end this thing. And so Washington saw this with a clarity that I think no one, even the naval people in France, completely understood as clearly as he did. And so that became his obsession throughout the alliance, was to get the French Navy up the Atlantic coast to help him out. Unfortunately, the French had their own priorities, and a lot of that involved the Caribbean. So it was a very difficult alliance from Washington's perspective.
But he sure pulled it off, didn't he?
He pulled it off. And, you know, that's another side. You know, he understood the sea. But he also was really adept at working the alliance. You know, I think we have a tendency in retrospect to think of the partnership between America and France as this, you know, benign, ideal melding of two great noble causes. But the fact of the matter, the French were only in it to take it to the British. They had been humiliated during the 7 Years' War, also known as the French and India War in America. They had lost Canada. Their ally, Spain, had lost Florida, Alabama, New Orleans to the British. And they were angry, and they wanted to take Great Britain down a peg and restore the power that France and Spain had enjoyed prior to the 7 Years' War. And so as soon as they entered the war, it turned a colonial rebellion into a world war. And Americans, I think, in their self-serving way, tend to think of the 13 colonies as the jewel in the empire's crown, when actually the real money was to be made in the Caribbean, in the sugar plantations. And so as soon as France and Spain enter the war, their navies head south into the Caribbean, and they duke it out. France gets Tobago, the British get St. Lucia. They're battling it out back and forth and leaving Washington all by himself. He's got a small French force in Newport, a small naval force with 5,000 soldiers under General Rochambeau, but the British Navy has a blockade, and they're bottled up there and unable to go anywhere. So once again, there's Washington engineering all this, and ultimately it would result in the Battle of the Chesapeake that would make possible the great victory at Yorktown.
And what an amazing story that is, and what an amazingly clear way that's presented in this book. I'm just in awe of the book. Folks, if you have not read In the Hurricane's Eye, you want to do it. Nathaniel, people can buy that almost everywhere, I'm sure. Amazon, all the bookstores, I'm sure it's out everywhere, isn't it?
It is. Penguin has just reissued the two previous books about the Revolution I've written, Bunker Hill and Valiant Ambition, and they repackaged them wonderfully. And so you can not only get In the Hurricane's Eye in paperback, but you can also get all three of them, the set. You know, it's been great to finally reach this point and see this war to its conclusion, because I've been working on it as long as the war itself. And it's been quite a deep dive and a fascinating one from my perspective.
And it's amazing how few Americans really understand our history. So three books that will help you understand as clearly as any three I could imagine our Revolutionary War and how and why we won it.
Yeah, and, you know, I think what people don't understand is, you know, without France, we would not have won our freedom.
Amen.
We needed that alliance.
Amen. Nathaniel, thank you. Thank you for your book. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Thank you. That book is a service to our nation because it makes clear about how our country began, truly. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Coming from you, it really means a lot to me.
Coming up next on Front Lines of Freedom, we'll talk with Bill Steffen about his veteran father on this, our Father's Day show. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Do 18 with each arm, then stand at ease, but do stay in the area. I'll be right back.
Now is the time, and wherever you are is the place. The Citadel makes it easier to earn your degree by offering master's degrees, graduate certificates, and undergraduate degree completion programs that are entirely online. These programs are convenient for working professionals and those serving in the U.S. military, continuing the Citadel's legacy of academic excellence. Classes are held to the same high standards that consistently name the Citadel the number one master's-granting public college in the South. The Citadel. Online, on your time. Visit citadel.edu/online.
For nearly 2,000 severely injured veterans, everyday life has become filled with barriers. So we build specially adapted homes at Homes for Our Troops. And thanks to our donors and supporters, this life-changing gift of freedom is provided mortgage-free to these veterans. But we need you to join us, too, in completing this important mission. Please visit HFOTUSA.org and help build homes and rebuild lives.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump addressing workers at an energy plant in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he spoke about China dumping cheap steel in the United States.
I mean, we need steel for defense. We need steel. What are we going to do? We have a little bit of a problem. We have a little bit of a conflict. We'll say, listen, China, could you do us a favor? We need help. All our steel mills are closed. Could you send us some steel, please? We don't make steel anymore. Well, we make it now.
The warden of the jail where convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein died of an apparent suicide is being reassigned. The Justice Department announced Attorney General Bill Barr made the decision to move the warden to the Bureau's Northeast Regional Office, pending the outcome of two investigations into Epstein's death. Two staffers at the jail were also placed on administrative leave until the investigation concludes as well. This is USA Radio News.
Hi, this is Wayne Alaruth, the Capitalist Evangelist. I'm here to introduce you to a special company with the potential to be one of the great all-American stories. Fortum Resources is a publicly traded, diversified natural resource company with oil, gas, and mining properties in North America and internationally. Fortum is led by Chairman Mark Bruner, the legendary oil man who built Ultra Petroleum from a 15-cent stock to $200 per share, creating $15 billion in shareholder profits. Mark has 30 years of experience in the oil and gas industry, overseeing contracts with Halliburton, ExxonMobil, and Hess. Fortum has over 350,000 acres of oil and gas resources, and more than half the acreage has been evaluated by world-renowned auditors Deloitte Touche. Fortum also owns the rights to the 180-square-mile City of Gold mining property. Fortum is traded on two global exchanges, U.S. ticker symbol FTMR. Repeat, FTMR. This is a rare ground floor opportunity to capitalize on a proven energy industry legend. Please visit FortumResources.com. That's Fortum, F-O-R-T-E-M, Resources.com.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is BobBurnsSpeaks.com. Please tune in to Living Consciously, where myself and my co-host will entertain you, inform you, and educate you in certain modalities. Living consciously is something that we really must learn to do, because that way you'll know what's going on around you. This show can be heard at 2 p.m. every Friday on HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Thank you.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Front Lines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at Danny at frontlinesoffreedom.com or do it on Facebook. Hey, Skip, what's the first one?
Mary, the mother of a Marine, really appreciated the interview with the lady who took Holocaust survivors to Poland. It made great sense to her that they also took young Israeli soldiers.
Agree, Mary. That was a great event, a great idea.
And Tim, an Army vet, liked the comparison of police and the military. He'd never thought of the similarities before.
Tim, we sheepdogs do have a lot in common, don't we? Okay, well, now it's time to honor a wonderful vet who's no longer with us. Gottfried Armin Fritz Fradelli was born on June 26, 1917 in Wisconsin at a home that was located above the family's cheese factory. At 18, Fritz hitchhiked and rode the rails to Colorado, Wyoming, and California. He worked at two different dairies and cheese manufacturing companies. Fritz enlisted in the Army in 1939 and was assigned to the Horse Artillery. A sergeant at the end of his two-year hitch, Fritz shortly thereafter joined up for the Army Air Corps. An officer convinced him to apply for officer's candidate school. He was commissioned a second lieutenant in 1943. Fritz was assigned to the 363rd Field Artillery Battalion in the 96th Infantry Division as a forward observer. His unit deployed to the Pacific and was in the fifth wave in the invasion of Leyte. Then Fritz went in the second wave on Okinawa. There he was shot through the neck by a Japanese sniper. He lay on a stretcher on the beach for 3 days, stable but totally paralyzed from the neck down, before being placed on a hospital ship. Fritz was admitted to the Letterman Army Hospital in San Francisco. After 7 months, he was able to walk again. He was medically discharged in October 1945 with 100% disability. In 1946, he enrolled in the University of Wisconsin and earned a degree in dairy science. He married Helen Bradfield on September 17, 1949, then moved to Tampico, Mexico, where he started a dairy business. They had four sons and lived there till 1962 when the dairy business was federalized. They returned to the U.S. and restarted their lives in San Antonio, Texas. Three of his four sons went into the military with ROTC commissions. The fourth son became a medical doctor. Fritz lived a rich and rewarding life until his death on December 22nd, 2004.
Colonel, he really gave a lot to his country, didn't he?
He did. Wow, I can't even imagine some of that. Well, it's military history time. Skip, lead out, bro.
On 17 June 1775, British General William Howe landed his troops on the Charlestown Peninsula overlooking Boston, Massachusetts, and led them against Breed's Hill, a fortified American position just below Bunker Hill. As the British advanced in columns, American General William Prescott reportedly told his men, "Don't one of you fire until you see the whites of their eyes." When the Redcoats were within 40 yards, the Americans let loose with a lethal barrage of musket fire, throwing the British into retreat. After reforming his lines, Howe attacked again, with much the same result. Prescott's men were now low on ammunition, though, and when Howe led his men up the hill for a third time, they reached the redoubts and engaged the Americans in hand-to-hand combat. The outnumbered Americans were forced to retreat. The Patriots' gunfire had cut down nearly 1,000 enemy troops, including 92 officers. Of the 370 Patriots who fell, most were struck while in retreat. The British had won the so-called Battle of Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, and the Charlestown Peninsula fell firmly under British control. Despite losing their strategic positions, the battle was a morale builder for the Americans, convincing them that patriotic dedication could overcome superior British military might.
And it did. And on 20 June 1864, during the Civil War, General John Bell Hood's Confederate force attacked William Sherman's troops outside of Atlanta, but they were repulsed with heavy losses. This was Hood's first battle as the head of the Army of Tennessee. He had assumed command from Joseph Johnson just 2 days before, when Confederate President Jefferson Davis replaced Johnson after Sherman had backed Johnson into this key southern city. Davis selected the more offensive-minded Hood to defeat Sherman. Hood wasted little time. He planned to strike the Union Army as it crossed the Peachtree Creek. The waterway was deep, and the Confederates destroyed all the bridges on the retreat into Atlanta. Hood suspected that Yankees were most vulnerable when only part of their force was across the creek, so he planned a two-pronged attack to hold part of the Union Army at bay while the rest could be pinned against Peachtree Creek. It was a sound plan, but poorly executed. Scheduled for 1 p.m., the attack was delayed for 3 hours while Hood's troops shifted into position. The overall assault lacked a general coordination, so units charged the Union position piecemeal. 20,000 rebels assaulted the same number of Yankees. The Confederates achieved some success, but couldn't drive the Union troops back. After 3 hours, Hood ordered a halt to the advance. He did try again later.
On 19 June 1944, in what would become known as the Marianas Turkey Shoot, U.S. carrier-based fighters decimated the Japanese fleet with only a minimum of losses in the Battle of the Philippine Sea. The security of the Marianas Islands in the Western Pacific were vital to Japan. Our Fifth Fleet was on its way west as backup for the invasion of Saipan and the rest of the Marianas, but the Japanese admiral decided to challenge the American fleet, ordering 430 of his planes, launched from aircraft carriers, to attack. In what became the greatest carrier battle of the war, our Navy, having already picked up the Japanese craft on radar, proceeded to shoot down over 300 aircraft and sink 2 aircraft carriers, losing only 29 of their own planes. It was described in the aftermath as a turkey shoot. Admiral Zawa, believing his missing planes had landed on their Guam airbase, maintained his position in the Philippine Sea, allowing for a second attack of our fighter planes to shoot down an additional 65 Japanese planes and sink another carrier. In total, the Japanese lost 480 aircraft, three-quarters of its total, not to mention most of the crews.
And that's military history for today. Skip, it's time for the Armed America Report. Let's do it this week.
All of us here at Front Lines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. Listen, folks, evil exists. Someday evil will visit your door. Will you be ready? If you're not, now is the time to start looking into it and learning the skills necessary to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Soundly asleep in her bedroom in Kansas City, a 74-year-old woman awakened to the sound of a burglar breaking her door open. Startled, the woman grabbed her recently purchased handgun and met the intruder at the top of the stairs, where she took aim and fired a single fatal shot. EMS arrived on the scene to save the life of the homeowner, who suffered a heart attack after the incident.
Colonel, I love stories like this, primarily, you know, especially when you've got like a 74-year-old woman, right? I get a lot of elderly people in my class, and elderly to me is anyone who's older than I am. So
careful there, dude.
Well, you know what I mean, Colonel. But, you know, these little old ladies, these grandmas, great-grandmas, come out onto the range, and they'll be shooting, and a lot of them can only handle a .22 caliber pistol because of the recoil, and
yep,
they can't rack the slide, all of this stuff. And some other big, tough guys, right, will ridicule them. But the truth is, I did the research on this lady. She was shooting a .22 caliber pistol. But, you know, when you shoot them in the head, it doesn't matter how big the bullet is. It really doesn't.
And my wife shoots a .22 mag.
Yes, that's right.
That will do some serious damage.
Definitely. You know, and the bottom line is, you basically, you shoot the highest caliber that you can safely and accurately control.